You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the latest from Brazil as voters get ready to cast their ballots in a key presidential election, plus news from China, Iran, and the war in Ukraine, all on the Friday News Roundup today at 6 on 1A+. Now, coming into this midterm election year, the expectation was that Republicans had a decent chance to take control of the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Could be a close call. That's in part because the party in the White House tends to lose seats in Congress in midterms. Now, months and millions of dollars in advertising later, it looks like Republicans have a decent chance to take control of the House, and the Senate is a close call. There's a lot at stake when it comes to control of Congress and a huge mix of issues that could influence voters. And while we, of course, don't know the results of the 2022 midterms, we're going to spend some time talking about what could happen in Congress depending on the outcomes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you have your eye on when it comes to midterm races? If Republicans take control of the House, Senate, or both, what are you hoping they do? What are you fearing they do? Same question if Democrats retain control of Congress. What thoughts do you have? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Julia Azari has been thinking a lot about this, teaching about it too. She's a professor of political science at Marquette University. She researches and teaches about the American presidency and political parties. She's authored the book Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we hear in many elections, this is among the most consequential of our lifetime, or phrases to that effect. How consequential, how important is this particular 2022 midterm election for Congress?
So I think there's sort of two answers to that question. One has to do with what kind of policies will come out of Congress if we have a divided government after this election. And I think there, you know, the question there is, what kinds of policies could we imagine a Republican White House, or excuse me, Republican House run led by Speaker Kevin McCarthy of California is kind of the presumptive candidate for that, and a Biden White House, regardless of who controls the Senate. I think the answer of what they might work on together is not very much. So I think we'll see something, if that happens, very similar to what we saw in the Obama years, where there's some brinksmanship over budget politics, where there's a lot of disagreement. There's a lot of messaging bills, a lot of kind of symbolic politics, knowing that very little will go forward. I think, you know, symbolically, and also in the realm of kind of some of the concerns that people have about the future of American democracy, we're going to see some really difficult questions come forward if this happens about how a Republican-led House kind of addresses some of the concerns that people had following the 2020 election. Do they follow what has become kind of standard opinion in the Republican Party about that election? Do they act on that in any way with regard to future elections? What will be their capacity to do that? So I don't want to downplay the very real, both symbolic and kind of really concrete consequences that can have from a policy perspective. I think we're looking at, you know, the possibility of a very deadlocked, divided government if that's what happens in November.
I understand you've been talking to your students about a similar situation. Again, a Democratic president, and if Republicans controlled the House, going back to 1994, I believe that was the Contract with America year, where you had a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, Republicans led by Newt Gingrich in the House. What lessons could we take from that?
Yeah, great question. I'm really excited to be dragging my students into what to them will feel like ancient history on Tuesday, which to me feels like fairly recent memory. 1994. So the Contract with America, what's interesting about that is that was a real kind of turn in congressional elections to really thinking about them as a kind of national event where people in different districts and states were running under kind of a similar banner. And the Contract with America really was kind of a House of Representatives thing. This year, the Republicans have sort of done something similar with a document called Commitment to America that has kind of their ideas about the state of the country and what they would do. There's a couple of interesting. So a key lesson, I think, is that not actually that many people are going to pay attention to this in the broader electorate. And now we think about this kind of national dimension as pretty natural part of elections. We would expect members of the same party to be on a similar kind of page. One thing that I thought was really striking from the Contract with America is that it largely avoided a lot of social issues, even though that was part of that campaign, was taking on what Bill Clinton had done in regard to social issues. But the document itself was really about economics, and it was kind of about governmental reform, changing the way things were done in Congress. This year, you know, the commitment to America does not shy away from these kind of divisive social issues. And I think that really shows you how much party politics has changed since then.
Talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at what's at stake in the midterm elections for control of Congress. Both chambers up for grabs. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, predictions, worries, questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think in the past when we had presidents and the rest of the government in different houses, like Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, for example, those are people in times when people could actually compromise and get together. But right now, we're looking at people like Kevin McCarthy and his cohorts basically saying that they're just going to let Donald Trump get away with armed insurrection. And they also want to use impeachment against Joe Biden and other people, Kamala Harris. And it just seems extreme to the extent where I really think democracy is in danger.
Tom, thanks for the call. Julia, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some pretty striking polling lately that shows that this is a widespread feeling among Americans, but also that people don't really have a sense of what to do about it. That's very striking to me. I think that the caller is kind of laying out a sense that a lot of people have, and that certainly, you know, if you've been watching the January 6th hearings and you have been kind of following what that committee, a sort of bipartisan committee, has been trying to do, it's, you know, a Republican House is not going to pick up on that work. That's just not going to happen. And I think that, you know, you always have kind of some seesawing between the two parties, but, you know, I think there are people who see that really as something much larger and having like a much longer term impact hanging in the balance. Impeachment, I think, is going to come up a lot. And I think it's important to think about impeachment as a kind of as something that reflects the politics going on in Congress. If the Democrats hold the Senate, the Senate is anybody's guess, then obviously, you know, a Republican House impeaching Biden, that those charges then won't really go anywhere in the Senate. And so I think it's important to think about what the political calculus will be for members of the House to do that. And on the one hand, it might be worth it to kind of do that in a messaging way and then say, look, these people didn't do anything. On the other hand, I think the reason even though we have this incredible partisan rancor, we don't see more impeachment efforts is because impeachment really is, I think, still seen as very kind of politically fraught and potentially very costly process.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I wanted to ask you about one possible tactic for a Republican-led chamber, one or both. The debt ceiling. And we've seen leading Republicans, including you mentioned likely Speaker, if the Republicans won the House, Kevin McCarthy, saying, yeah, we're probably going to use the threat of a shutdown over a vote on the debt ceiling to extract policy concessions as opposed to, you know, trying to just pass things that a president's going to veto. How important is that?
So it's hard to know at the outset exactly what these dynamics will be like, but that was certainly what we saw during the Obama years. And I think that one thing that's sort of critical about that is that it's really not evident that anyone paid a political price for that sort of budget kind of showdown that happened over the course of Obama's kind of the latter part of his first term in particular. And there was a, you know, very close to kind of crisis in the summer of 2011. And that was, you know, it wasn't really clear that the electorate honestly reacted very strongly to that, either to say, yes, we want to see more the sort of budget austerity, or no, we were very concerned about the U.S. defaulting on its debt. The policy consequences for the latter are something you should ask somebody who knows more about the global political economy. But my understanding is it's quite dire. This is not a joke. But I think that kind of really high stakes sort of party conflict was not uncommon in the Obama years. I can think of reasons why that might not be the tactic this time around. For all the kind of public politics has been every bit as nasty as it was in the Obama years, the sort of congressional actual legislating has been a little bit more bipartisan with the Biden administration. So you can imagine that might not necessarily be the case. But, you know, I don't really have any reason to believe either that the politics between the two parties will be a lot calmer than it has been in the past, or that anyone will shy away from very, like I said, very high stakes kinds of tactics.
We're talking to political science professor Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at the midterm elections and what's at stake depending on which party emerges with control of one or both chambers of commerce. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the most important things you see being at stake when it comes to which party controls Congress? What do you hope to see? What do you worry about depending on who ends up winning the control of the House in particular or the Senate? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the midterm elections and the stakes for which party or parties control the House and Senate. Julia Azari stays with us, professor of political science at Marquette University. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts, hopes, fears, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now with Justin in Algoma. Justin, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My question for Professor Azari, is this a good time for a gridlock? If the Republicans win both houses, is it time for the states to step up and be a little bit less politically divided?
Interesting, Justin. If we can't get things done at the federal level, is this a time where states will take the forefront?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of agnostic on that question. I think there are ways in which when the states step up, that can be good. There's kind of clear ways that, you know, states have a lot of variety in the kinds of policies they might need. There's other ways where that can be really chaotic and, lead to a kind of situation in which you need some kind of central federal policy or where that becomes a way to make life worse for some people. So I think that really depends. I have been in the past like somewhat of a defender of gridlock in the sense that if the country sort of split on something, then, you know, we should figure out a way to do something that a lot of people can agree on. The problem with that I see right now is something that people in the political science community have been talking about for some years now, which is this idea that what's driving the disagreement between the two parties isn't just issue disagreement. And you can have a really different position on an issue and still come to some agreement about what the problem is and find a compromise solution that doesn't do everything that anybody wants, but that does some things for kind of a wide range of people and that improves things on balance for as many people as possible. That is a thing that can happen, but it can't really happen when the two parties are fundamentally seeing each other as enemies. And there are people who have arguments about the way that this might not be symmetrical between the two parties. I don't think I have time to sort of go over all the different evidence, but it's clear that's part of the equation here is that it's not that there's gridlock because there's always disagreement on issues. It's that there's gridlock because one side doesn't want to hand the other side a win. And they see it as an opportunity for gain, an advantageous thing for them to kind of sabotage the other side. And that's, I think, sort of across a lot of different viewpoints among scholars and journalists in the political realm. That's the thing that I think we see is really, is really damaging to the governing process. That just makes governing impossible.
Justin, thanks for the call. Dennis joins us now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Yeah, that's what I was getting into, is it's, they kind of be like Groucho Marx. If the other side is for it, they're against it. Because sometimes, I mean, one example is when Trump was in office, he wanted to be sure he got his signature on the checks that went out to us. But then when the Democrats are in charge and they're sending out checks, then the Republicans are totally against it. So it just depends on whose idea it is and who's in charge.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Dennis referred to Groucho Marx as Rufus T. Firefly in the movie Duck Soup. But that, whatever it is, I'm against it. Negative polarization shaping actions for voters and for members of Congress, Dennis says, Julia.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if I could have put it better. That's a really good example. What's interesting about that is that in the previous administration and also in this one, there have actually been things that have come out of Congress where they've managed to come up with some points of agreement. There was a kind of, I guess I would call it, it was a gun bill, but it was kind of like a broad context gun bill over the summer that dealt a lot with like mental health type of issues. And that was bipartisan. You had bipartisan infrastructure. You have the COVID relief, and both administrations has had some support. That's just, you know, this is the thing I think that a lot of people are finding very frustrating, is that certainly when you go out into the electorate, Republicans and Democrats have different viewpoints. They have reasons for their beliefs, but they also have concerns that they share in common and the possibility for compromise. And the current structure of our politics just is not terribly conducive to that. And there aren't a lot of political incentives for that. And that seems to be the sort of catch-22 that we are stuck in. And that, again, I think is kind of what we're looking at. When it comes to thinking about a possible divided government in 2023. So, I mean, I think that that's also something people can think about as far as those political incentives. Members of Congress behave the way they do because they think that's what they have, that's what's in their best political interest. And voters have some power there. And, you know, joining up with other people to kind of pressure members of Congress to compromise on important issues, that can work. I think that is probably the only thing that does work. And so I do want to sort of emphasize how I hear the frustration in each caller's, each caller's comments and voice, but also to emphasize that we are still part of this equation as citizens.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. I want to spend a little bit of time, Julia, on, we've been talking about after the election and the what ifs. What might shape the outcomes? I won't ask you to make any predictions, because who can really do that? But what are you watching for that could swing outcomes in one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been really a challenging couple years in this regard, because it's not totally obvious what shapes outcomes. The polls this fall look like they have shifted a lot toward the Republicans. Even that, there's a debate among experts about whether that's just a matter of shifting to looking at likely voters as opposed to just registered voters over the summer. That often is sort of a Republican shift. In terms of what happens in the next couple of weeks, honestly, the main thing I'm looking at is mobilization, is how the two sides are mobilizing their voters. And the last two elections, 2020 and 2018, have had very high turnout. And that turnout has been, those increases have been pretty even across the two parties. So it might be a wash. It certainly was in 2020, but I'll be looking at that, because I think that's really the main thing that is going to make a difference. Now, I don't know that the things that the candidates are saying or doing is making a big difference at this point.
Over the last bunch of months since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the Dobbs decision, we've seen a few elections, a referendum in Kansas, a couple of special House elections where there was kind of a hidden phenomenon, it seemed like, in the polling of younger women in particular becoming likely voters where pollsters might not have considered them that in the past. Do you think that's something that might hold in 2 weeks?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been puzzling a lot about this, and people have now been sharing early voting data to the extent it's available in Pennsylvania, here in Wisconsin, that I think does show a little bit of an advantage for women voters in Wisconsin. I am very hesitant to put too much stock in early in like this sort of partial data, early voting data. But I think that you might see if there's that effect, I think it's likely to be small. That said, a lot of these races are really close. And the generic ballot for the House of Representatives is basically even. There's a number of critical races in the Senate, like six of those that are just incredibly close. In a close election, anything can matter, and a small change can make the difference. So I think that's the case. I do think what we're seeing in Senate races and in governor's races is that in this sort of bigger race than a House race, that there's just a more complex set of issues. Similarly with the Kansas referendum, which was very direct. It was very clear what people were voting on. And in a Senate race, we can pick up on a lot more different factors and dynamics. And so that might at least partially crowd out that issue.
Julia, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julia Azari, professor of political science at Marquette University, author of the book Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate, with us for a look at the midterm elections and what's at stake when it comes to which party ends up controlling the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a case on affirmative action in college. We'll check out the arguments and find out what's at stake for higher education and beyond. That plus some ghost stories coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, advice on how to exercise, how to get some physical activity when it might feel hard or even impossible. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk about fall comfort cooking with Midwestern food writer Jennifer Rood-Klett. First, exercise has been proven to decrease anxiety, depression, and stress, and boost self-esteem, mood, and energy. But knowing the psychological benefits of exercise doesn't always make doing it any easier, especially if you're already struggling with mental health problems. Winter months bring more barriers to exercise. It can be tough for a lot of us to get off the couch. Our next guest has advice to help us overcome barriers to exercise, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you find most challenging about exercising, getting physical activity regularly? What advice do you need on how to do it? Have you found a way to build it into your routine, whether it's a trip to the gym or a quick walk around the neighborhood? And in the winter, what do you do to stay active? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Cadmus-Bertram is an associate professor of kinesiology at UW-Madison, leader of the Cancer Prevention and Control Program at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Can you tell us a little more about the psychological benefits of exercise?
Certainly. Well, physical activity has many mental and physical health benefits, and it's really one of the best ways that we can sort of both reduce our risk of experiencing anxiety and depression, and also to help manage those symptoms if you're somebody who already experiences one or both of those.
Do we know why exercise, or even just, and I want to distinguish exercise or even just physical activity, why are they so good for our mental health?
Yeah, well, I think that they do provide, you know, the stimulation that often helps us to break out of cycles of worrying or rumination, which characterize both anxiety and depression for a lot of people that suffer from it. And there's also a lot of ongoing research around, you know, the mechanisms that underlie the physiologic response that exercise creates. So through inflammation or endorphins, or other pathways, even including endocannabinoids, which are cannabinoid factors that are produced from within our bodies rather than something that we take in from outside that can help us to have that feeling of well-being.
Now, I just made a distinction that I think might be important, exercise or physical activity. Now, sometimes if we think, oh, exercise, that means I have to spend an hour doing cardio or go to the gym or the pool or whatever. That's great, but smaller amounts of physical activity that we might not even think of as exercise can have some of these same benefits. Do I have this right?
Yeah. So one of the big ways that our national physical activity guidelines changed in the past couple of years is we no longer have any minimum requirement for the amount of sessions, the length of a session that's thought to be beneficial. So if you think back 10 or 20 years, you may remember hearing, oh, you should do exercise 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. And then around 2008, they said, well, actually, it turns out that it doesn't really have to be 30 minutes. It could just be 10 minutes at a time. And now that we have a more evolved scientific literature around physical activity and health, we actually understand it's the total volume of physical activity over time that really matters. So it is absolutely sort of an every minute counts way of thinking of things, where even short sessions or short bouts of physical activity are really important to our mental and physical health.
I want to speak to a very particular group of people, people dealing with depression and other forms of mental illness. They may know that exercise would help them, but easier said than done. In some ways, your brain is working against you when you're trying to get motivated. What thoughts do you have for people in that position?
Absolutely. I think that one piece of advice that I have that is great for people who are struggling with depression, but also applicable to anyone else as well, is when you're thinking about exercise, how to get motivated, how to get started, to try and come at it from a place of curiosity rather than a place of guilt, thinking I should be doing this. Why am I not doing this? Why can't I get off the couch? But really sort of looking at your habits and thinking, you know, when it's time for me to exercise and I'm not doing it, like, what am I feeling? Like, what am I experiencing? And then trying to troubleshoot from there. The other thing that I really, well, two other suggestions that I have. One is to really focus on the frequency of physical activity over the intensity or the duration of sessions. So if you can get out and, you know, especially if you can get outdoors, especially if you can find somewhere with green space. We're learning more and more about how important that is to our mental health. But even get out for those very short periods of time, and you can just tell yourself, all I'm going to do is 5 minutes. All I'm going to do is 2 minutes, or whatever you feel is feasible. And once you're out the door, a lot of times you will find that you feel ready and able to do more. Not every time, but a lot of times. Another suggestion is one of the things that tends to coexist and is part of depression is sort of social withdrawal or isolation. So physical activity can be one way that you can reconnect with people. If there's somebody that, you know, you enjoy talking with, maybe getting together with them for a walk kind of is a two birds with one stone type situation, because it's going to help bring you some social connectedness and also give you a sense of accountability. So, you know, whether depressed or not, for a lot of people, knowing that you're going to meet somebody to go be physically active together is a lot more motivating. You're much more likely to actually follow through with that than if it's just an intention that you have to do alone.
We're talking to Lisa Cadmus-Bertram from UW-Madison's Department of Kinesiology, looking at the mental health benefits of exercise and physical activity and the motivation and how to get it, how to build routines around getting some activity. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Angela joins us now in Baraboo. Angela, hi.
Hi. Yeah, actually, it's an echo of what she just said. When I'm not motivated, I tell myself I'm only going to do this for 10 minutes. And sometimes I'll even set the alarm on my phone. But then, sometimes after 10 minutes, I quit. I'm like, I'm done. But normally after 10 minutes, it's like, well, I can go another five. Well, I can go another five after that. Oh, well, you know what? I've done 20. I might as well do 30 minutes of activity.
That's great, Angela. And do you find that after that 10 minutes or once you get rolling, do you feel like it boosts your mood a little bit?
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, I'm a runner, and running to me is just kind of like, it's almost like going to church. some of the most amazing experiences I've ever had in my life have been when I've been on these runs just out in the country.
Angela, thank you so much for sharing that story. I appreciate it. So yeah, as she said, Lisa, she was echoing that if you do a little bit, that might be the first step to doing a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. And on those days when you do the 5 minutes and you don't feel like continuing, then, you know, it's important to remember, then the next step is to pat yourself on the back because you succeeded and you did those 5 minutes. And that's extremely important.
Thanks again for calling, Angela, at 800-642-1234. Now, Lisa, I know you work with patients at the Carbone Center who are in many cases recovering from cancer. And there's a paradox when it comes to fatigue, which could be for the patients you're dealing with and others. Sometimes we can solve our fatigue by getting some exercise. But sometimes, and we've talked about long COVID on the show, sometimes fatigue is a sign that we need more rest. How do we sort out what's causing our fatigue and what to do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So especially for people going through cancer treatments that are causing fatigue, it is a bit of a cycle because physical activity is one of the most effective ways to deal with the fatigue. But of course, when you're feeling fatigue and going through it, the last thing you want to do is go be physically active. And I think a lot of other people experience that as well. For people who have fatigue and they're not really sure if they need more activity or more sleep, I think in a lot of cases, the answer may be both. And that's where really taking a look at your sleep hygiene can be so helpful and focusing in on, you know, just those standard things like trying to go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time, make sure your sleeping area or your bedroom is nice and dark, avoid screens or blue light for an hour or two before bed. And I think that, you know, if you stick to those, that those things alone can be beneficial for a lot of people.
We're talking about ways to get physical activity, even when we're unmotivated, maybe fatigued, maybe feeling depression, maybe when it's freezing and dark outside, or you just plain don't feel like it. Lisa Cadmus-Bertram is with us, Associate Professor of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you personally experienced mental health benefits of physical activity of some sort? Have you had trouble getting motivated? Have you found ways to build activity and exercise into your daily routine? Do you have questions? Need some advice or maybe inspiration from our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how to exercise when we really don't feel like it with Lisa Cadmus-Bertram, Associate Professor of Kinesiology at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble building exercise and activity into your routine? Did you find a solution that worked for you? Where do you see the mental and emotional benefits of exercise? Do you feel it? Are you doing something right now that's making you feel better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa, I know for me anyway, maybe I'm the only person like this. If I'm counting on willpower to solve any problem, including getting more physical activity, I might as well just hang it up. It's got to be, something else, something I structure into my day or build a routine about. How important is that?
For a lot of people, it's incredibly important. You know, we're all able to brush our teeth every day. There's other things that are just part of our habits and part of our lifestyle. And I think to the extent that folks are able to find a place where physical activity can fit in the same spot in their schedule every day, that's one approach that can be very successful for helping people to get it done and get it into their day. For other people who have a lot more variability, perhaps in their work schedules or their caregiving responsibilities, it can be a little bit more difficult to sort of create that very steady habit where they're doing the same routine of physical activity at the same part of the day. And that's where you have to get a little bit more creative and maybe mix it up a bit more.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Ted is with us now in West Allis. Hi, Ted.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your exercise story, Ted?
Well, I've got a few comments to make. One of them is I am 70. I retired 4 years ago, and after the first, month, I put on probably, 10 pounds, and I immediately joined a couple of gyms. And as I hope most retirees understand that, when you get on a Medicare Advantage plan, they all have gym memberships included, no charge to you whatsoever. And you can join up to, at least with my plan, there's 8 or 9 different gyms that are on the list. You can join them as many as you want because they only get paid when you clock in, swipe in, whatever. And what I found is that, you know, if you don't have anything really planned for the day, you don't know what to do or whatever, I think just getting up, getting off your butt, you know, either taking a walk, go to the gym, whatever, it's going to get everything moving, your heart moving, which is going to pump more blood to your brain. I just feel like somebody mentioned like going to church, and I find that a very good analogy. I think they all tie in body, mind, spirit. And I think, you know, one feeds the other. And as you feed each of those, I just think the benefits take care of themselves.
Fantastic, Ted. Thank you so much for sharing that story with us. Lisa, one thing I wanted to key in on, and you can go where you want with it too, is Ted had a big change in his life. He retired and found that he needed to do something different. How can that disrupt our level of physical activity when we make a big life change like that?
It can be a huge disruption. Retirement's a big one. You know, starting a new job, having a baby is probably having a baby and retiring are probably the two biggest ones that really disrupt people's daily patterns. So both of those, I think the approach he took is a fantastic one. And I'm so glad you brought that up because that's a resource that's available to everybody who's on Medicare. And there's a lot of different ways to access that through a number of different community resources. But, you know, when you're making a big life change, it's a great idea to be mindful of how that's impacting other habits that you're having around your physical activity, your diet, and your sleep, and then starting to strategize about, you know, whether you're satisfied with how things are looking now or whether there are some changes that you might be interested in making. The other great thing about, you know, finding access to gyms, especially for older folks, is one of the things that we've learned through our research with people living in rural Wisconsin is that there are, you know, sometimes more barriers, especially as we head into this part of the year where the days are shorter and a lot of people may not be comfortable, you know, exercising outdoors when it's dark, especially when we start to get those slippery sidewalks. And especially for older folks, you know, you got to be really cognizant of risks of falls and things like that. So while I do encourage outdoor exercise, I think finding access to gyms is also a really important part of the puzzle if you're able to do it.
Another thing I love that I heard from Ted there was when he said, when I don't have anything better to do, you know, and, you know, we might pick up our phone or watch a TV show or whatever, and those are fine things. But having that on our roster of not doing anything else, why not go for a little walk? That could be an easy way to fit in some extra activity.
Yeah, absolutely. Or both, right? So one of the things that I enjoy while I'm exercising is watching shows or movies if I'm, you know, indoors and on the treadmill, or listening to music or podcasts outdoors, or even if you're out walking, you know, calling a loved one. Sometimes I go out for a walk for exercise and call my mom. So sort of combining so you can do something that you enjoy at the same time that you're getting your physical activity in.
Thanks again for that call, Ted, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Elizabeth in Genoa City. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Well, you know, I started doing yoga when I was in my 20s on television before computers were invented. And I put together a series of things that I keep tweaking through my life. I'm 62 now. I've been doing it almost every single day for 42 years. And I can tell when I don't do it how I tighten up. So I try to encourage other people to do it. Or if you've never done it, it's to me stretching and, you know, moving your body different ways so that you use and you massage your organs in the meantime inside. So then you could do chair yoga, which I've tried, which is really, really good if you've never done it before. So I just encourage it so much for people because I feel like I'm 30 and I'm 62.
Not bad, Elizabeth. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Lisa, yoga as a part of our toolkit here.
Fantastic. Thank you for your call and for this comment. That's especially as we're talking about emotional well-being and mental health. Yoga is absolutely amazing because it combines stretching and physical activity with that meditative component. So really combines a lot of, you know, physical, mental benefits all into one package.
Thanks again for that.
I would also add, I like that you mentioned chair yoga. Sometimes people who are not as familiar with yoga might think, oh, you need to be very flexible. You need to be very limber. Well, there's many different types of yoga and can be adapted for any type of functional ability. So you're truly not too old or too young to be able to enjoy and benefit from it.
Elizabeth, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Lisa Cadmus-Bertram, Associate Professor of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, looking at the mental health benefits of exercise and helping us get motivated to do exercise, to do physical activity, whatever situation we might be in. Still time for your call, if you call quick, at 800-642-1234 with your story or your question. Lisa, I want to dig a little deeper into winter now. You mentioned that as an issue for seniors, and safety and ice, that's out there for all of us. But how about overcoming the motivation problems of exercise? When it, the night is a lot longer. It gets dark earlier. It persuades me not to exercise sometimes. I'll admit that.
Okay, so I have three ideas here. One is to think about if there's ways that you can incorporate exercise during the middle of the day so that you can get the benefits of the sunshine and, as well as some increased safety while you're exercising. So perhaps if you're retired, that's a little bit easier for some folks. If you are still working, then, depending on your occupation, you may or may not be able to fit some short walks into your workday. Another approach is to think about what you can do to make exercising a little bit more appealing or safer outdoors. So making sure that you have good reflective apparel, that you have lights, maybe that you're walking with a friend, choosing well-lit, well-shoveled areas to walk on can be really important as well.
Yeah, my wife and I got little blinking lights for walking after dark. They're pretty dorky, but they do the job.
To that, and the other thing is that we are blessed here in Wisconsin with absolutely beautiful winters. And there's so many wonderful things that we can only do during winter, including some things like cross-country skiing, which are very gentle, very accessible. And if that's something that appeals to you, I would encourage checking it out, because I think that if you can find those special things that you can enjoy outdoors that you can only do in the winter, then, yes, we have the cold. Yes, we have the wind. Yes, we have the darkness. But we also have some things that we can look forward to during those really cold months.
I wanted to ask also about physical barriers to exercise. People might be, as with some of the people you work with, I'm sure, recovering from cancer. Some people might have chronic pain or an injury that they're recovering from. I mean, the list goes on and on. Do you have some suggestions on how people who have particular physical barriers can find the kinds of exercise that are still going to work for them?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that physical activity is so important for everyone, regardless of age or physical limitations. And so depending on your specific condition or injury, obviously it's going to vary a lot, but there's more and more resources available online. You can talk to your doctor or other providers, or look for programs like here in the Department of Kinesiology. We have an adapted fitness program, which is designed to provide physical fitness training to people living with a really wide variety of disabilities, and they're partnered with undergraduate students to assist in that training. So there's a lot of opportunities out there, and you just kind of have to find what's the right fit for your particular situation so that you can get the benefits that you're looking for and make sure that you're doing it in a way that's going to be safe, that's not going to set you back with your recovery or exacerbate your condition or create other risks.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Lisa Cadmus-Bertram, Associate Professor of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, leader of the Cancer Prevention and Control Program at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. She talked to us about ways to make exercising and physical activity easier when you're struggling with barriers, including mental health, physical health, and more. If you have a story of how you found a way to stay active and you had to overcome some of those barriers, love to hear it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, lentils, garlic, oats. Are you cooking or baking with those this fall? Our Food Friday guest is, and we've got some great comforting recipes and advice to share with you. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.